This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delandados Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, environmentalists from Russia have come to the Northwest to look for ways to cope with some of the environmental problems left by the Cold War. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger today refused to spare the life of Stanley Tookie Williams. And a Lebanese journalist is an outspoken critic of Syria was killed today in a Beirut car bombing.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,146 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 42,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 30,892 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 12th. I'm Lisa Lewis.
And I'm Andy Seaton. Portland City Transportation Commissioner Randy Leonard is leading an effort to convert the city's vehicle fleet to alternative fuels. In 2004, the city began using B20, a blend that contains 20% biodiesel, and all of its diesel equipment such as mowers, dump trucks, and backhoes. New city ordinance would convert those vehicles to at least a B50 blend containing 50% biodiesel, and non-diesel vehicles would be replaced with the goal of eventually converting the entire fleet, with the exception of emergency vehicles, to diesel or gas-electric hybrids. The effort is part of a larger vision that Leonard's that would have many stations carrying biodiesel across the state and city. Biodiesel is made from barley, soy, and other crops, as well as waste grease from food service or processing industries. It is a renewable energy source produced domestically. Carbon dioxide and monoxide emissions are substantially reduced in vehicles that use biodiesel blends, and biodiesel's higher lubricity helps engines run more smoothly.
Members of the community activist group ACORN organized a sightseeing event in the Lentz neighborhood Saturday afternoon. Live on the phone to talk about it is ACORN member James Sherman. All right, we will have that up for you in just a minute.
Workers and concerned citizens are gathered in Portland and around the world this week to protest the World Trade Organization. The WTA is holding its sixth ministerial meeting in Hong Kong beginning tomorrow. KBOO's Julie Sabatier reports for FSRN.
Today we gather to march in solidarity with the people of Hong Kong, to struggle in the solidarity as they fight for their rights, and also to stand up for our own.
An estimated 1,000 people turned out in Portland, Oregon, Saturday to say no to the WTO and yes to the right of workers to organize. The march and rally helped to kick off a week of protests in cities around the globe, such as Seattle, Jakarta, and Hong Kong.
Really, this is an expression of our humanity.
Stuart Acoff is the National Director of Organizing for the AFL-CIO.
We're saying no. We're not going to allow faceless, nameless, soulless corporations to take over our lives and our future.
The rally's heavy focus on labor services and union activity drew attention to a local labor struggle when the march passed by the Benson Towers. The $30 million Octagon development project is contracted with a non-union Canadian construction firm. Organizer Dan Denver with the Portland Central American Solidarity Committee was among those who took the protest into the Benson building.
It was wonderful. We marched right in there, about 100 of us, and the staff people there were really freaked out, and I think we sent a really strong message that Portland is a union town.
Despite a strong police presence at the march, there was only one arrest made all day. Portland police did not respond to FSRN's request for comments on the incident. Dan Denver stressed that the overall mood of the event was nonviolent.
It's been really peaceful, but at the same time, it wasn't just a protest where, we walked around and said, preach to the choir and no one paid attention. And I think just bringing this incredible diversity of people together really said a lot.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Julie Sabatier in Portland, Oregon.
Also with the WTO protest Saturday, KBOO's Cherie Blackfeather asked participants about their views on public gatherings. She filed this audio snapshot.
Food, shelter,
healthcare,
education,
green space. Talking about the commons, how do you identify the commons? Things that we all share, that's right, or that we should all have access to, right? What about the airwaves?
Airwaves to get news out to us, to get word out to us, to get information, sure, absolutely.
But how do you identify the commons?
The commons are resources that are available to everybody, or should be. Air, water, food, those kinds of things.
What about patenting life forms? And
the fact that somebody can tinker a genome into a certain form doesn't mean that they own it.
I'm asking people today how you identify or you define the commons, like in a modern sense today. What would you identify as the commons?
Commons are everything that we have in common, like the parks, the roads, and the things that we all share and use every day as a citizenry.
What about privatizing those things?
Well, I think anytime you privatize the commons, you integrate and profit into it. It's wrong, because that should never be a part of our water supply and our air supply and the things that we all share.
What does it have to do with the commons, this event today?
Well, for me, it has to do with keep making sure that all people have equal access to job protection, ability to make a livable wage. If you use the people in Iraq right now that are fighting the same corporate entities that we are fighting in many ways, in other words, Halliburton or KBR that come into Iraq, taking jobs away from the unions in Iraq that have been there for many, many years, those are the same people that we fight for union protections and union, you know, against. So if they can't win there or we don't win here, we both lose. It's the same. It's a world economy, and so the jobs are just not localized anymore. We oftentimes get overwhelmed by so many things that, you know, focus gets diverted from a concept like that. But it is our earth.
That was KBOO's Cherie Blackfeather. And now we go back to the story about Acorn, where members of the community activist group organized a sightseeing event in the Lentz neighborhood Saturday afternoon. We have on the phone live with us James Sherman. James, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What was the purpose of Acorn's bus tour?
Well, us being neighbors of Lentz, we feel the city of Portland doesn't think this neighborhood is a priority, and that city officials are ignoring the crime issues in our communities.
What sets Lentz apart from other Portland neighborhoods?
Well, it's certainly a well-established neighborhood. It's a neighborhood of tight-knit people that have lived here for long periods of time, and we've got an influx of people coming from other places. It's just it's a great neighborhood, and I'm sure there's other great neighborhoods around, but it's being overlooked as far as the crime issue is concerned.
Did you get a good turnout?
Yes, we did. We had a very positive and enthusiastic turnout from many of our neighbors who are concerned about these issues.
What do you hope will come from the bus tour?
Well, one thing for sure, Acorn is about taking action until we get the changes we want for our neighborhoods. Two, hopefully some exposure, because we want our neighbors to know about Acorn and that we need their participation. The more members we have, the louder our voices become, and the louder our voices, the more people will have to listen.
All right. Thank you, James. That was James Sherman of Acorn.
The Bonneville Power Administration says efforts to protect salmon account for about $10 a month on the average monthly household bill. BPA spokesman Ed Mosley said the per-household cost emerged from a court battle last month and is the first time federal agencies have calculated how much private households pay for such programs. The cost per household varies because local utilities draw different amounts of power from the dams. 31 federal dams supply about 40% of the Northwest's electricity. But environmental groups dispute the BPA's calculation, saying the household's cost is more like $7 a month.
The Oregon Trail School Board will vote tonight on a proposal for making up some of the days lost during the four-week teachers' strike this fall. In the new contract, approved November 16th by teachers and the school board, both sides agreed to restore 8 of the 16 school days lost during the strike. Three of the 8 days would be converted from staff development days into student contact days. 2 days from spring break would also be converted into school days, and 1 day would be added to the school year in June. The board already approved changing 2 winter break vacation days into school days. The new contract ended nearly 2 years of negotiations in the district, which serves about 4,200 students in Sandy, Boring, Welch's, and other Mount Hood communities.
Last week, a group of environmentalists from Russia visited Washington State. They were in the Northwest to look for ways to cope with some of the environmental problems left by the Cold War. KBOO's Marianne Barosinek files this report.
Chernobyl is probably the most notorious nuclear disaster, but it's not the largest. The first Soviet nuclear weapons were produced in Chelyabinsk in the Ural Mountains. Accidents and radiation releases left the area highly contaminated. The accidents were secret for many years afterwards because the area was closed to the outside world until 1992. Gosman Karabarov is chairman of TECHA, an NGO that's promoting the rights of people living in the Chelyabinsk area. I asked him what sort of health problems they're seeing.
Genetic mutation, because every fourth child was born genetically have mutant genes. For 60 years, since 1949, we have this.
Most of the mutations aren't readily apparent.
Rarely it's physical changes. Usually it's a problem with the immune system, like people getting older much faster. Even with rare pneumonia, percentage of the dead will be much higher. But mainly it's oncological. And also another problem, it's the women can't have children.
Even though the area is not well known outside of Russia, the scope of the problem is huge.
The number of official victims is 500,000. Unofficial number you can increase 3 times. But total population in our area is over 2 million people.
Some of the areas are contaminated with long-lived radionuclides, and Khabarov is not optimistic about their future.
Specifically, our area, I cannot see any future, because most of the radio materials that it will take 20,000 years. I would say, like, in 40 years, those little villages, everybody will be dead over there anyway.
Igor Mustak is the program coordinator for the Ural Ecological Union, an NGO that's also working in the Chelyabinsk area. He's focusing on another source of health problems for the region.
And maybe it's not as dangerous as a nuclear, but chemical weapon also can affect population and future generation as well.
1/4 of the chemical weapons from the former Soviet Union are being stored in aging warehouses in the Chelyabinsk region. The U.S. government has given money to Russia to build reprocessing plants.
Yeah, of course, such a huge quantity of this chemical poison and weapon, everybody could suffer.
The everyone he refers to isn't just people in Chelyabinsk or even in Russia. It's in our own best interest to see that the weapons are dismantled. Gosman Khabarov.
It's kind of for us strange to hear that the U.S. afraid that somebody going to steal those materials they will bring to the United States. It's much easier for the terrorists just blow up that over there, and the air flow will bring this stuff everywhere. It's much worse even.
People in Russia are seeing their environment degrade, and they're looking for ways to get their government to work more effectively on the problems. Igor Mushtak.
It's very important to find a solution. That's why actually we came here, to see some kind of mechanism in the United States about what kind of action can be taken. And actually, the borders I think between the countries is kind of symbolic, because we all are living on this planet, Earth.
For KBOO News, this is Marianne Barasonic.
Last month, Portland police mounted an enforcement action at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th Streets. Police issued 29 citations and 33 warnings to bike riders, twice as many as motorists received. Some cyclists thought the crackdown unfair. As a result, bike activists tried a demonstration of a different kind last week, one where everybody made a point of following all the rules. It was called the Super Legal Bike Ride. KBOO's Sarah Stout, host of the bike show, has more.
About 20 bike riders headed out last Thursday evening to the intersection of Southeast 26th and Clinton and rode through the intersection repeatedly for about a half hour. They stopped completely at the stop signs, signaled, and obeyed every law that applies to vehicles in an exaggerated fashion. Brian Scrivener describes what he thought the ride accomplished.
We demonstrated that the traffic is definitely held up a lot more when bicyclists adhere strictly to the law. There was no doubt when you see the activity at the intersections that motorists had to wait a lot longer.
Another rider shared his thoughts.
What we were doing tonight was going out to demonstrate the unfairness of the police department's targeting cyclists at multi-use intersections.
Jason Worster also thought the enforcement action was unfair.
There's a big difference between a car and a bicycle. If I hit a person on a bicycle, I probably won't kill them. But if a car hits me on a bicycle, it'll do a lot more damage. So I think the laws need to be proportional to the amount of damage that could be done.
Police say the enforcement action was meant to educate all road users. Ellie Blue thought it was a waste of resources.
Motor vehicle-related crashes are one of the top three causes of death in the United States, and that has nothing to do with bicyclists at all. And people in this town talk about how bicyclists are such a big problem, but in fact, I think it is a much smarter idea to focus on enforcing motorist behavior than on cyclist behavior. So I think that cyclist education is an important issue in this town. There's a lot of groups doing really good work on that, and I'd like to see that work continue. I don't think that police officers writing citations is the best way to educate cyclists.
She thought it might be time for a law change.
I think it would be great if we had legislation that allowed cyclists to treat stop signs as yields.
That's the traffic code in Idaho for bicycle riders, where it's also legal for bicyclists to proceed through red lights when there's no cross traffic. Cities in Europe have similar laws.
I certainly don't advocate blowing through a stop sign, but I think coming to a complete stop is ridiculous. And Holland's a great example of a culture of a place where people aren't required to stop. They use a stop sign as a yield, and their accident rate is like a sixth of ours.
For now, the law in Oregon remains. Cyclists, motorists alike, need to stop completely at stop signs or face a $234 fine. And police say enforcement actions will continue throughout Portland. Bicyclists say they will respond with an even bigger, super legal bike ride coming up in the spring. I'm Sara Stout, reporting for the news on KBOO.
Using simple tools like shovels, draw knives, and axes, local residents and volunteers from other states have been building another replica of the Lewis and Clark Expedition's Fort Clatsop 2 months after its predecessor burned. The initial work is being done at the Clatsop County Fairgrounds, where volunteers are stripping logs that were donated by area timber companies. After stripping off the bark, workers remove the cambium layer to expose the raw wood and make the logs bare for preservative treatment. Logs will be hauled to the Lewis and Clark Memorial Historical Park to be assembled on the site of the burned replica in March 2006. However, the location of the original fort built by Lewis and Clark is still unknown.
Southwest Oregon's Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest has become the latest national forest to turn away from cutting old-growth trees, moving instead towards less controversial thinning of younger stands. The move reflects a broader trend by the U.S. Forest Service to give up logging of big old trees that yield large volumes of valuable wood that have been a rallying cry for forest defenders. Other national forests, including the Siuslaw, Gifford, Pinchot, and increasingly the Mount Hood, are no longer offering old-growth trees for sale to timber companies. Controversy surrounding such cutting often drains funds and leads to such long holdups that the projects may never proceed. The Rogue River Siskiyou is now moving in the same direction. Forest Supervisor Scott Conroy last week canceled the homepage timber sale, a 7-year-old project to log virgin forest that has been embroiled in lawsuits. Nobody bid on it when it was put up for auction in September. Federal foresters have to now rework the sale at extra cost before auctioning it again.
The current time is 5:19:42. And now on today's Earthwatch report, pine tree rings in Georgia tell the history of hurricanes that hit the region.
Old pine trees can tell stories about hundreds of hurricanes. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. It's easy to count the rings of a tree to determine its age, but if you look closely, you can learn more about the history of the tree and the world it lived in. Claudia Mora looked at the rings of an old pine tree from Georgia, and she found a history of hurricanes that goes back 200 years. Mora is a geochemist at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. She says big storms like hurricanes leave a chemical signature on the rain that they bring ashore.
Rainwater contains oxygen. We all know water contains hydrogen and oxygen, but it turns out that not all oxygen atoms are alike.
One form of oxygen is the isotope oxygen 18, and rainwater from hurricanes has unusually low concentrations of it. Mora says that chemical signature is embedded in the tissue of trees when they soak up rainwater after a hurricane. Finding that clue means taking tree rings apart cell by cell. Mora says the cells that form early in the growing season are loosely spaced and light-colored. Later in the year, the cells have thicker walls and they're packed closer together, so they're darker in appearance.
When you're counting tree rings, you're actually jumping from dark ring to dark ring to dark ring, saying each of those represents the end of an annual growth cycle.
The end of the growth cycle for southern pine trees coincides with hurricane season, and Mora says the tree rings carry the imprint of the storms forever. Mora says this work has a very practical purpose. People are trying to understand the history of hurricanes to see if they're becoming more frequent. Tree rings might give an accurate accounting of these storms for centuries and help people understand if anything about them today is unusual. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
The current time is 5:22. And still to come on the KBOO Evening News, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger today refused to spare the life of Stanley Tookie Williams. A Lebanese journalist and outspoken critic of Syria was killed today in a Beirut car bombing. The sixth ministerial conference of the World Trade Organization is set to open tomorrow in Hong Kong. You are listening to Community Radio, KBOO in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River.
California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has denied clemency to Stanley Tookie Williams, who is scheduled to be executed by the state at 12:01 a.m. tonight. In what may be his last public interview, Tookie spoke with WBAI's wake-up call this morning about what he would like to leave behind as his legacy.
That is redemption. I can say it no better than that. That's what I'd like the world to remember me. That's what I'd like my legacy to be remembered as. A redemptive transition. Something that I believe is not exclusive just for the so-called sanctimonious, the elitist. And it does, and it's not predicated on color or race, social stratum, or one's religious background. It's accessible for everybody. That's the beauty about it. And whether others choose to believe that I've redeemed myself or not, I worry not, because I know and God knows, and you can believe that all the youth that I continue to help, they know too.
That was Stanley Tookie Williams speaking on WBAI's wake-up call this morning. The state of California has scheduled his murder for midnight tonight.
More than 3 years before the 9/11 attacks, U.S. officials warned Saudi Arabia that Osama bin Laden might target civilian aircraft. This, according to a declassified cable released by the National Security Archive Friday. KBOO's Jacob Fenston reports.
The warning was made in 1998 by a U.S. regional security officer and a civil aviation officer in Riyadh. The warning was based on a bin Laden interview with ABC, in which he threatened attacks on military aircraft. Barbara Elias of the National Security Archive says State Department officials realized that civilian aircraft could be an even easier target for terrorists.
Being the very astute people that they are at the State Department, they said, okay, military aircraft are one thing, but the real easy target is going to be civilian aircraft. So they're talking to the Saudi officials and security screeners at the airport in Riyadh. They're saying, you know, you need to ramp up your security because Bin Laden is contemplating terrorist activities, and the easiest target we can think of would be civilian aircraft.
Barbara Elias acquired the memo through a Freedom of Information Act request. She requested the release of all documents related to Bin Laden's 1998 ABC interview. She wanted to know how seriously the State Department was taking Bin Laden's threats. Elias says this memo indicates that as early as 1998, officials were already concerned about terrorist attacks using civilian aircraft.
Oftentimes when you talk about 9/11, a lot of the conversation kind of focused on how no one ever thought of using planes as missiles and people never thought about targeting of civilian aircraft. And yet if you go back to 1998 to this memo, it's very obvious that people who were within those circles were thinking about these issues pretty seriously.
This memo is not the first indication that the government knew about such threats. In September this year, the New York Times reported that the FAA also issued similar warnings in 1998 and 1999. The FAA reported on the, quote, possibility that the terrorist group might try to hijack a commercial jet and slam it into a U.S. landmark. I'm Jacob Fenston, KBOO News.
Checkout time has been extended for Hurricane Katrina evacuees. The Federal Emergency Management Agency wanted to move all of them out of their hotel rooms by early next month, but a federal judge today ruled that they must be allowed to stay until February 7th. The temporary restraining order came in a lawsuit filed by advocates for hurricane victims. Attorneys for those victims say that FEMA hasn't provided aid for many people who are still eligible. They also say information on the aid hasn't quickly reached the people who need it the most.
You've heard of sports teams selling the naming rights to their arenas. But now, a radio station in Wisconsin is raising some eyebrows with the sale of the naming rights to its newsroom. After the first of the year, station WIBA in Madison will call its newsroom the Amcor Bank News Center. No word on what the bank is paying. The owners of the station say they're not the first to do this. They say a Milwaukee station sold its newsroom naming rights to a bank last year. An ethics specialist at the Poynter Institute says it's a bad move and that corporate branding of a newscast will taint the whole product. But officials at Amcor say they don't expect any preferential treatment.
Today starts what's likely to be the last congressional week of the year. FSRN's D.C. correspondent Mitch Jezerich takes a look at some of the more controversial measures the Congress is likely to enact.
About 50 immigrant rights activists and workers demonstrate outside both the National Democratic and Republican headquarters against a bill likely to be voted on this week in the House of Representatives that would criminalize visa violators. The measure, being brought by the Republican chair of the House Judiciary Committee, James Sensenbrenner of Illinois, would also require local law enforcement officials to enforce federal immigration laws and would further limit appeals on immigration rulings. There will also likely be an amendment later on this week that would change the laws guaranteeing the right to every child born in the United States citizenship. Fredricio Herrera, a janitor in the Washington, D.C. area, sees the bill as an attack against immigrants.
That's what we're afraid of. Also, the local police, we're not going to be our friends anymore. You know, if we're trying to say something to them, we're going to be scared. So it's going to be like we're going to be like enemies with the police. We're going to be afraid of them. They were not going to be our friends anymore. If this bill passed, so it's going to be difficult for us and also for our children who are born in this country. It's a violation of the Constitution because whoever born in this land has to be legal.
Besides law enforcement, the House proposal does not include any measures on how to deal with 11-plus million undocumented immigrants living in the United States. While the House is poised to vote on the bill this week, the Senate will take up its own version in the new year. Congress will also attempt this week to reauthorize the Patriot Act, as several provisions will expire on December 31st. Civil libertarians and some Democrats are expressing extreme disappointment with a new proposal that basically extends the Patriot Act for another 4 years.
The conference report is an irresponsible affront
to civil liberties.
Jerry Nadler is a Democratic representative from New York who served on the Patriot Act House Senate Conference Committee.
Moreover, the government could continue to obtain sensitive and personal tangible business items on a mere showing of relevance if this conference report is agreed to. This very low standard, which is said to go along with the Senate's Patriot Act reauthorization language, does not require any connection to a suspected agent of a foreign power and is therefore a dangerous affront to civil liberties and gives carte blanche to the government to conduct fishing expeditions.
The Patriot Act reauthorization measure also extends Section 215 of the Act that allows the FBI to obtain library, bookstore, and business records. Roving wiretaps and sneak and peek provisions would also be extended. Democratic Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin is threatening a filibuster against the bill. It's unclear, however, if he has the support to succeed. Civil libertarians are also watching another measure this week, the Senate Intelligence Authorization Bill, that could expand the Pentagon's authority to conduct surveillance operations inside of the country. The Senate Intelligence Authorization Bill would expand the authority of the Office of the Counterintelligence Field Activity inside of the Pentagon to analyze domestic information gathered by the four branches of the military. There are reports that such surveillance has already begun. The Congress will also grapple with the defense authorization bill that includes an amendment by Republican Senator from Arizona, John McCain, that would outlaw torture when using interrogative methods with so-called enemy combatants. The White House is seeking to amend the measure to exempt the CIA, and Republican Senate Leader Bill Frist told Fox News Sunday that they are close to a deal.
I did vote for the amendment, but I also said 5 minutes before the vote on the floor of the United States Senate that I want to make absolutely sure that when we're talking about terrorists, not prisoners of war, but actual terrorists, that we have the full range of legal ability to get as much information as we possibly can when those terrorists have vowed to take out your family, to take down the United States of America.
Other published reports have contradicted Frist's assertion that they are close to a deal. Senator McCain has indicated he would not alter his anti-torture legislation to exempt the CIA. However, depending on what comes out of the Senate House Conference Committee, McCain might not have a choice. Mitch Cheserich, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
And now, commentary from Seattle journalist Jeff Parrish.
No strategy, no victory. This is Jeff Parrish. Last week's presidential speech at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis was supposed to be a major new statement of Bush administration policy goals in Iraq. The simultaneous release of a 35-page national strategy for victory in Iraq was supposed to show the country and the world that the Bushes had a plan. Any plan. It didn't. The most striking aspect of the National Strategy for Victory in Iraq is that it contains no strategy for victory in Iraq. It doesn't even define victory. No measurable goals, no benchmarks for success, nothing. Bush's assessment of the situation on the ground in Iraq is so utterly delusional that it doesn't matter anyway. You can't decide how to get somewhere if you don't know where you already are and you don't know where you need to go. The speech and the document are more of the same. More lofty rhetoric, more touting of non-existent progress, more stay the course, more freedom and democracy, and blah, blah, blah. It's a complete and utter abandonment of responsibility for a horrific mess entirely of the president's making. Let's review. As I noted last week, civil war in Iraq has already begun. The government, put in power by Bush and his cronies, the one taking orders from the American embassy, is torturing prisoners and running death squads. The new Iraqi military being crimped by Bush is comically inept, serving mostly to funnel recruits and weaponry to the insurgency. Bush's touted electoral process is riddled with fraud and Sunni voter suppression. Women have far fewer rights than under Saddam, and Sharia law is being enforced by cleric goons in much of the country. Leaders from across Iraq's political spectrum want a negotiated settlement and want a timetable for U.S. troops to leave. The Iraqi public is overwhelmingly hostile to Americans. The insurgency continues to grow in both scope and ferocity. Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups have found a new operating base in the world's most lawless country. Untold numbers of Iraqi civilians continue to be caught in the crossfire, and young American soldiers continue to die. Amazingly, Bush's speech reflected none of this. The speech has to be considered a cruel joke in Iraq, and for that matter, in most of the rest of the world. It was intended for a domestic U.S. audience, and intended solely to stop the hemorrhaging in public support for the war and for the president. It won't. Americans, and bless them, a few Democrats too, have begun to ask some hard questions of Bush's folly. The questions didn't go away when the White House tried bullying critics, and they won't go away after this bit of cheap cheerleading. We've heard all this before. It took Bush exactly 27 seconds to fraudulently invoke 9/11. We're fighting them over there so that we don't have to fight them over here. The enemy is terrorists who, being inhuman evildoers, are waging war against humanity. All part of the continuing White House effort to peddle the long discredited myth that the insurgency is fueled by foreign fighters motivated by religion rather than homegrown nationalists motivated by a foreign occupation of their country. Even the Pentagon doesn't believe that crap. Plenty of Republicans are coming to the realization that this issue is going to cost them elections in November 2006. There's nothing like the fear of losing power to force changes in policy. To that end, the fate of all those Iraqis caught in the crossfire is firmly in the hands of the American public. It's one thing for opinion polls to show that half the country wants an immediate withdrawal, more than half thinks the White House lied, and a solid majority thinks the war was a mistake. It's another thing entirely for the public to get so mad about it all that they force the architects of this unnatural disaster out of office. Representative John Murtha, in making his pivotal call last month for an immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq, noted that Congress and the White House were way behind the American people. They still are. For KBOO, this is Josh Parrish.
Republican Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist threatened yesterday to strip Democrats of the power to filibuster if they block the vote of the Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito. Frist's willingness to consider the procedural measure called the nuclear option seemed somewhat premature. Last week, Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Arlen Specter said he anticipates intense questioning of Alito during next month's hearings. Specter does not detect a strong sentiment for using the filibuster to stay the vote on Alito. Specter said, and several Democratic senators said they intend to press Alito on his writings on abortion and states' rights. Under Senate rules, a senator can thwart action by talking nonstop. It takes 60 votes to override a filibuster, which means a Frist would need every Republican and five Democrats to force a vote. But Frist said he is, as he's done in the past, he said that he would be willing to seek a parliamentary ruling declaring the filibuster cannot be used in judicial nominations. He would need only a simple majority, 50 votes plus the vice president, to uphold that view.
A partnership of federal, state, and local officials proposed a 15-year, $20 billion plan today for cleaning up the Great Lakes, the source of drinking water for 30 million people and a vital link in the nation's shipping network. The plan makes numerous recommendations on how to fix the lake's most pressing problems, including the proliferation of invasive species, the deterioration of animal habitats, toxic hotspots blamed on pollution, and tainted wetlands and tributaries. President Bush last year ordered the EPA to assemble the partnership to coordinate Great Lakes cleanup efforts. The move followed a Government Accountability Office report describing existing programs devoted to restoring the lakes as disjointed. Eight states and two Canadian provinces border the lakes, which contain 20% of the world's fresh surface water.
An alliance of progressive organizations and community allies gathered together in Los Angeles to commemorate the 57th annual Human Rights Day by honoring victims of human rights atrocities in the Philippines. The festivities coincided with the celebrations hosted by the AFL-CIO throughout several U.S. cities. FSRN's Lilani Albano reports.
Teledito Dacot, Victor Caben Concepcion, Angelina Besunia, Noel Viones, and Ricardo Ramos are among the hundreds of Filipino victims of state-sanctioned torture, assassinations, and forced detention under the Gloria Macapagal Arroyo administration. They were among those commemorated in this year's Human Rights Day festivities on Saturday. Political violence in recent months has drastically escalated in the country, following failed attempts by activists to impeach President Arroyo for voter fraud earlier this year. According to organizers, 874 cases of human rights violations were committed in this year alone, making 2005 the worst year for human rights atrocities following the Marcos era. In all, there have been more than 4,207 human rights violations since Arroyo took office in 2001. Tony DeRonio, who is a member of the Asian Pacific American Labor Alliance, explains that Arroyo's forces use the Bush-led war on terror as an excuse to target her opponents.
There is a war on terror that is supposed to be waged by the government of the Philippines against terrorists. However, the government doesn't give distinction between the legal workers and the armed revolutionary forces.
As one result, more labor leaders are being killed by military troops, according to Bayan USA, a human rights organization. Melissa Rojas is chairwoman of Hobby Arts, a multimedia collective.
You know, for every labor leader that's killed, it's representing a growing movement in the Philippines.
Most of these killings have occurred in central Luzon, amidst rising tensions between farm workers and armed forces at the Hacienda Luisita sugar plantation, which is owned by the family of former Philippine President Cory Aquino. Although laborers celebrated last week after winning concessions following an 18-month strike, the price of victory was high for workers. Liza Camba, an APALA member, recalls her visit last November to the plantation, where violence broke out at the picket line.
During that day, I experienced one of several attempted violent dispersals, where they were throwing, you know, tear gas and spiked water, cannons of water into the crowd.
On November 16, government troops entered the labor dispute, killing six and wounding 72 people. Seven supporters of the Hacienda Luisita strike were also murdered. News of the atrocities is slowly gaining attention in the United States. APALA member Tony DeRonio says Filipino activists are teaming up with the American Federation of Labor to combat the increasing aggression against unionists.
As a response, the President John Sweeney came out with a statement and also a letter written to the President of the United States condemning and demanding investigations on the murders of labor leaders.
He also says organizers will be launching a national campaign next year to call for a U.S. congressional inquiry into the murders of labor organizers. For FSRN, this is Leilani Albano in Los Angeles.
The current time is 5:42, and now, daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
I'm whopper-jawed. I'm stunned. I'm sick. I'm disgusted. I'm fuming. If you thought that you could no longer be shocked by anything the Bushites do, you've obviously not heard of the latest inhuman, totally depraved, appalling bit of evil coming out of Bush's EPA. These so-called environmental and health protectors have proposed a new rule regarding the testing of toxic pesticides on humans, a deplorable practice that the chemical makers have long favored. Because EPA had been caught supporting tests in which children were intentionally dosed with pesticides, Congress mandated in August that the agency issue a rule permanently banning such pesticide tests, without exception. In September, EPA issued its proposed rule, hailing it as, quote, a landmark regulation on human studies, and flatly declaring that certain kinds of human research can never be acceptable. Beyond its flowery declaration of ethical principles, however, EPA's proposal is 30 pages of fine print that viciously guts those very principles by giving the pesticide corporations clear-cut exceptions to the supposed ban on human testing. Get ready to puke. For these are some of the exceptions. Neglected or abused infants can be subjected to pesticide tests without the consent of parents or guardians. Mentally handicapped and orphaned infants may be used for tests for the sake of research. Also, EPA will accept industry pesticide tests done on children outside the U.S., including in countries with minimal or no ethical standards. Not only do these repulsive exceptions violate even the lowest level of human decency and morality, but they also are in direct violation of Congress's mandate to allow no exceptions to the ban on such tests. This is Jim Hightower saying, call the Organic Consumers Association to help fight EPA's proposal. 218-226-4164.
Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Stay tuned for Independent Native News following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m. here, Labor Radio. At 7 is Time Sound with Kevin Berry. Tonight's weather, mostly cloudy with lows of 30 to 35 degrees. Tomorrow, partly sunny with patchy fog in the morning, highs 40 to 45. You're listening to the Giggling KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and the Hood River.
The sixth ministerial conference of the World Trade Organization is set to open tomorrow in Hong Kong. Both police and protesters are preparing for mass mobilizations. FSRN's Aaron Glantz reports from Hong Kong.
A day after a massive rally by migrant workers here in Hong Kong, the offices of one of the leading organizers has been raided by police. It was the second time this week the organization's offices had been raided. Meantime, a delegation of high-profile Filipino activists were detained at Hong Kong's airport. The delegation included the leaders of the Philippines' largest feminist organization, its largest leftist organization, and its largest trade union. Norma Binas, the vice chair of the May 1st Movement Labor Center, was escorted by 10 riot police into the airport basement for interrogation. Binas says the interrogation lasted 6 hours.
And they have a two-page questionnaire whether we are involved in the anti-globalization rallies, protests in our own country. And then we said, of course, he said, I told them what is the situation of the workers. They're losing their jobs, they're losing livelihood and all this. So people are very angry with what's going on, and the government is not doing anything.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Hong Kong.
Journalist and lawmaker Gibran Tueni, a relentless critic of Syria who spent months in France fearing assassination, was killed today in a car bombing, only one day after returning to his homeland. A previously unknown group claimed responsibility, but suspicion quickly settled on Syria, where the state-controlled media has been highly critical of the anti-Syrian reports by the Lebanese journalists. The slaying silenced the blistering editorial voice of Tueni, the 48-year-old general manager of Lebanon's leading newspaper, Al-Nahar, founded in 1933 by his grandfather. His motorcade was attacked hours before the United Nations released a follow-up report on its probe of the February car bomb assassination of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. The report by the chief UN investigator said new evidence reinforces the investigators' belief that Syria and Lebanese intelligence likely knew about the Hariri killing in advance.
Five Islamic militant groups are calling this week's election in Iraq a satanic project. In a joint statement released today, the groups, including Al-Qaeda in Iraq, said the election violates God's law. They vow to continue their war to establish an Islamic government in the country. The Internet statement made no threats to disrupt the parliamentary elections, unlike in the lead-up to similar elections in January and October. The militants warned then that they would attack polling stations to stop people from voting. The statement's authenticity could not be independently verified, but if real, it's a rare instance of several of Iraq's militant groups joining together to announce their stance.
Israeli soldiers arrested a number of Palestinians today during incursions to the West Bank cities of Nablus and Jenin. FSRN's Manar Jabrin reports from the West Bank.
The Israeli army invaded Nablus this morning and arrested five residents. This comes after a separate incursion yesterday, which claimed the life of one member of Al-Aqsa Brigades. Meanwhile, soldiers have sealed off access to and from Jenin and its surrounding areas for the third consecutive day. One Palestinian youth from Jenin was arrested today after he attempted to stab a soldier guarding the gate that leads to the military camp near the city. So far, a total of 17 of West Bank residents have been arrested during the current military operation. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, I am Manar Jibrin.
Chileans went to the polls yesterday for the fourth time since the end of Pinochet's dictatorship. From Santiago, FSRN's Jorge Garatón has the details.
Center-left candidate Michelle Bachelet will have to wait until next month to see if she will become Chile's first female president. She received 46% of the vote in Sunday's election, so she will face a runoff next month against billionaire businessman Sebastián Piñera, who finished with 25% of the vote. In yesterday's ballot, Bachelet faced a strong challenge of two right-wing conservative candidates, billionaire businessman Piñera, and hardline conservative Joaquin Lavín. Also running was leftist candidate Thomas Hirsch. Bachelet, a medical doctor, hopes to lead the ruling coalition to his fourth presidential term since the return to democracy in 1990. Chile prepares now for his second runoff election in its history. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has ordered Israel's armed forces to be ready to, by the end of March, for possible strikes on secret uranium enrichment sites in Iran. The order came after Israeli intelligence warned the government that Iran was operating enrichment facilities, believed to be small and concealed in civilian locations. Iran's standoff with the International Atomic Energy Agency over nuclear inspections and aggressive rhetoric from the Iranian president, who last week said that Israel should be moved to Europe, are causing mounting concerns. Defense sources in Israel believe that the end of March may be a point of no return, after which Iran will have the technical expertise to enrich uranium in sufficient quantities to build a nuclear warhead in 2 to 4 years. If the military operation is approved, Israel will use air and ground forces against several nuclear targets in the hope of stalling Tehran's nuclear program for years, according to Israeli military sources.
A strong earthquake jolted northwestern Pakistan today, the scene of a devastating quake 2 months ago. There were no immediate reports of damage or injuries. The U.S. Geological Survey said the quake was a magnitude 6.7 and was centered in the Hindu Kush region of northeastern Afghanistan. Salim Khan, an official at the Peshawar Earthquake Center, estimated the quake to be about magnitude 6.5. It struck shortly before 3 a.m. local time. A magnitude 7.6 earthquake on October 8th killed at least 87,000 people in northwestern Pakistan and Indian Kashmir. A magnitude 6 quake can cause severe damage.
A protest is underway outside the U.S. naval base in Cuba, where American activists are trying to draw attention to treatment of terror suspects at Guantanamo Bay. The activists are members of a larger Christian group called Witnesses Against Torture. They're demanding access to the prison camp so they can meet the inmates. They arrived last night at checkpoint about 5 miles from the base after a five-day march from eastern Cuba. One demonstrator, Frida Berrigan, says, quote, "We are closer to these prisoners than their family members have been since they were arrested." She is the daughter of late Vietnam War protester Philip Berrigan. Inside the prison itself, 32 prisoners are on hunger strikes to protest what they say is cruel and inhumane treatment. 25 of them are being fed through tubes.
We totally forgot about the problem. That's the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 12, 2005. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Kirk Vanderveer. Our assistant producer is Noah Eaton. Tonight's audio editors are Noah Eaton and Jacob Fenston. Special thanks to reporters Marion Barasinek, Cherry Blackfeather, Jacob Fenston, and Sarah Stout. Our engineer is John Delderfield. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. And I'm Lisa Lewis.
And I'm Andy Seaton. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. Coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., here are the KBOO Morning News. That's all right here on your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us.
Independent Native News for Friday, the 9th of December. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. The Alaska Intertribal Council has passed a formal resolution on global warming during its four-day annual meeting in Anchorage, which wrapped up this week. AITC is the only organization that represents Alaska's sovereign tribes, according to board co-chair Mike Williams, who says membership is open to 231 federally recognized tribes in the state.
And it's the only tribal voice in Alaska.
Speaking from a cell phone, Williams says right now there are 190 tribes officially signed on as AITC members, but he says there is open participation for everyone.
You know, all the tribes need to get involved with AITC.
Williams says the resolution adopted at this week's meeting sends a strong message to Washington about how Alaska's collective tribes feel about global climate change.
You know, it has a profound effect on our lives as tribal peoples from western Alaska to the north. And we just keep hearing stories over and over from the tribal leaders that erosion, it's having an effect on the tundra, and our berries and our subsistence way of life is being affected by this global warming.
Unlike resolutions adopted at the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention, Williams says resolutions adopted at the AITC annual meeting come directly from sovereign tribal entities rather than tribal corporations. He says there has not been a lot of support to adopt new emission standards or even acknowledge the problem from Alaska's congressional delegation, but Williams is hopeful that will change.
You know, I hope to get their support. It's going to, you know, be hard to communicate with them, but we will communicate with them on this, on our issues of climate change. So, so I'm hoping that we would start beginning the dialogue.
Erosion is taking a toll on Alaska's coastal villages, and Williams says that alone should make Alaska's senators and congressmen take a good look at the long-term cost of global warming. One example is the Inupiaq village of Shishmaref, which is sliding into the Chukchi Sea. It's estimated to cost $100 to $200 million to relocate the village further inland. Meanwhile, in British Columbia, a report has recommended preferred ways local civic governments can prepare and deal with finalized treaties. As Craig McCulloch reports, the release of the consultant study comes as half a dozen bands try to complete treaty negotiations.
The 32-page report analyzes how failed land claim treaties will affect local civic governments, not provincial and federal governments that have been publicly and actively involved in negotiations for years. Entitled Treaty Settlement Land, Fiscal Impacts on Local Government, it was prepared back in October, but was just made public this past week. Not surprisingly, it found that including civic governments early in the treaty process is key, especially concerning such issues as water and sewer services to areas that are and might become part of a finalized treaty with a local First Nation. The report also outlines the concerns of civic governments and looked at how agreements in other parts of British Columbia and Canada affected local communities. The British Columbia Provincial Government and the Union of British Columbia Municipalities commissioned the study and hope it will become a starting point for future discussions. The report details examples of how First Nations and local communities have cooperated in different parts of Canada after a treaty in those areas were signed. For years, municipal governments have expressed concern over how treaties may affect city property and the resulting loss of tax revenue and potential parkland. The Nishka of Northern British Columbia are the only First Nation in the province to have a finalized treaty, which was done outside of the purview of the BC Treaty Commission. That commission was set up in 1992 to facilitate such agreements, and has so far failed to finalize a single one. There are only six of British Columbia's First Nations that are in the final stages of negotiations. I'm Craig McCulloch in Vancouver.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Sanosky Chambers Law Firm of Albuquerque, San Diego, Anchorage, Juneau, and Washington, D.C., defending Native American interests since 1976. And by Ridolfi Incorporated, designing and implementing restorative community development. RIDOLFI.com.
Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.